This gourmet dining establishment, on the 46th floor of the Seafirst building in downtown Seattle, provided a spectacular panoramic view of Elliott Bay and the Olympic Mountains. There were flat mirror surfaces on pillars by the windows, reflecting the views from a variety of directions. When the conversation grew too serious, Mom touched Dad's arm and asked him to tell a favorite joke of hers, one I hadn't heard in years. Dad told it like this. There were these old friends, and one of them finally turned to the other and said, "Alfie, we've been friends for a long time, and I can barely tolerate you putting down my stories, and the way you're always late to my parties. Most of all, I've just now decided I absolutely cannot tolerate the fact that you've become so pretentious." To this, Alfie responded, "Pretentious? Moi?" Dad provided a brief history lesson about the use of the French word moi, meaning I or me. He traced it back to Louis XIV, king of France longer than any other monarch, who said, "L'État, c'est moi. I am the state." All of us gave our opinions of the meal, while Mom scribbled bar notes on a notepad from her purse. The waiter seemed a little nervous, and I saw him watching her. On August 31st, 1983, we drove my parents to Rosalini's Other Place restaurant in Seattle for a 6:30 dinner reservation. Walking in from the car, Mom had to stop and catch her breath twice. "It's nothing," she said. "I've just been a little tired lately." We ordered a bottle of Richebourg before eating. With only two bottles remaining on the premises, a 1979 and a 1966, Dad said, "We'll have the 79 now and the 66 with dinner." He wanted to build up to the better, richer wine. The waiter removed the cork from the 79 and set it on our table. With a very serious, intense expression, Dad smelled the cork. Then a smile broke across his mouth, and his blue eyes sparkled. "Grind this up, will you?" he said, "and put it in our salad." Our waiter, a cheerful, portly fellow, laughed so hard that he nearly popped his cummerbund. It was a favored Frank Herbert line in elegant restaurant settings, delivered with a sense of comic timing at an ostensibly serious moment. It deflated any semblance of pretentiousness, which he abhorred, and never failed to elicit hearty laughter. One evening, we were enjoying a spare rib dinner, along with a big bottle of Chianti. Dad told a story about a group of literati gathered in New York City, discussing which foods went with certain wines. Science fiction writer Ben Bova was talking about Chianti, and a pretentious woman asked, aghast, what food could possibly go with a wine like that? To this, Bova responded, "Peanut butter." When the diners thought about it, they realized he was absolutely right. Only one wine, Chianti, had a strong enough flavor to keep from being drowned out by the flavor of peanut butter. My father found the discussion highly amusing. Soon we were immersed in our dinner and in conversation about my parents' upcoming trip to Hawaii. Mom said she always enjoyed the flight across the ocean, and that a wonderful feeling came over her when the Hawaiian Islands came into view through the windows of the plane. She described the islands as green and brown jewels on a shimmering aquamarine sea. Mom said she was glad she'd gone to Mexico City to see the Dune filming, that for her it had been the trip of a lifetime. "A Channel 5 Seattle news team was with us," she said, "but they won't run a story until the movie is ready for release." To build up public interest, Universal and De Laurentiis were keeping the cast list secret. I saw a television story on the movie, run by Channel 7 in Seattle, in which they interviewed the mysterious and unnamed leading man with his back to the camera. It was Kyle MacLachlan, I knew, but not too many other people did. 2 days afterward, on September 2nd, Clyde Taylor called and told me that W.H. Allen, a large publishing house in London, wanted to publish Sidney's Comet and The Garbage Chronicles in the United Kingdom, in hardcover and paperback. I told him to accept the proposed terms. Later in the week, I called Mom in Port Townsend and discussed the Ba newsletter with her. We went over the format and specific language that might be included in every issue. She wanted it to look elegant. She and Jan spoke on the telephone for a long while, after which Jan told me my parents wanted us to visit them in Hawaii that winter. If I wouldn't fly, Jan wondered, would I mind if she went alone? Mom said she was afraid Dad would steamroll her on the interior decorating at Kawaloa, and she wanted Jan there to prevent that. I assented. Details were worked out, but because of school, Jan couldn't go until after Christmas. Mom expressed disappointment and said, "Come as soon as you can." After discussing this with my mother by telephone, Jan sat silently for a long while and then asked me if she should interrupt her classes and go earlier. Knowing the difficulties she had been through at school, I suppose I didn't answer very well. I left the decision to her. The following week, I mailed my mother 4 restaurant reviews I had written, using a form I had developed for the purpose. I also edited a sample bar letter she wanted to mail to a selected list of people and offered my suggestions for improvement. We were establishing a tone with the letter, appealing to a discriminating class of diners. Mom had decided not to show her name anywhere in the publication, to guarantee the integrity of calls she made upon restaurants. She was afraid that restaurateurs, upon learning a food critic was on the premises, would roll out a red carpet. So, despite her earlier excitement about receiving credit in the publication for her operation of it, she was now slipping once again into anonymity. Her point seemed well taken, however. On the 16th of September, 1983, Dad called. He said Warner Brothers and Paul Newman were making a bid for the movie rights to Soul Catcher, my father's 1972 novel about a clash between American Indian and white cultures. Previously, there had been interest from a Seattle production company, Gardner Marlowe Mays, as well as from Robert Redford, Marlon Brando, and Henry Fonda. I found myself unable to keep up with the history of these film rights. It was turning out to be almost as complex and ill-starred as the early history of the Dune movie project. My father said he had a possible ulcer from tension over all the things he and Mom had been trying to do. The construction at Kawaloa was on the very top of their stress list, and below that, their struggle over selling the Port Townsend house and purchasing something closer to me. Temporarily, they had stopped looking for property in the Seattle area, but would resume the search in the spring, upon returning from Hawaii. His stomach didn't feel good, and to compound matters, he was battling the flu. He was grumpy from flu shots, said his muscles were so sore that he could hardly walk up the stairs to his riding loft. Despite this, Dad rode his 10-speed Schwinn bicycle to a market in Port Townsend the following day, a distance of 6 miles round trip, and purchased fettuccine for the evening meal. On September 23rd, I called Mom, and she said Dad was feeling a little better, but she wasn't. Only 2 months before, she had been up to 4.5 laps of the swimming pool, and now she could barely do one. As she spoke to me, I realized this was an unusual conversation. Previously, Mom didn't like to talk about her condition, and we had to receive information on it from Dad. I was worried. She said both of them had doctor's appointments in Seattle on the 29th. She also wanted to take her gold wristwatch to see Ryan and Associates to have the band shortened so that she could wear the watch again. "I want to buy a gold maple leaf coin at Ryan Precious Metals, too," she said, "in the same building. I've just begun collecting coins." She asked if I would take her, and I said I would be glad to. I told her I was just finishing my novel, Sudana, Sudana, which was coming in at around 310 pages, double-spaced, or 75,000 words. She said Dad had 300 single-spaced pages done on the first draft of Dune 6, and that she had gone over the plot with him, offering comments. I also suggested a title to him, she said. Chapter House Dune. He likes it. That's the title now. Mom cleared her throat and said the newsletter idea was dead because of a rival publication already in existence. We discussed business matters I'd been helping them with, and then I had to listen to one of the things I hated to hear, that she and Dad were executing living wills, giving one another the authority to pull the plug if either of them slipped into a vegetable state. My mother paused, as if awaiting comment. I didn't say anything. What could I say to that? She added that if both of them were being kept alive by machines, they wanted to give me the authority to pull the plug, and she asked if I would do that for them. I said I would do as they wished. It was a quality of life issue, she said, of particular concern to her. Dad once told me she used the term frequently, that she wanted the right to die in dignity, without the interference of unnatural and uncomfortable medical equipment. It was why she wanted to live at Kawaloa when she was so ill, despite its great distance from hospitals and modern medical equipment. She didn't want to die in a cold, sterile hospital, connected to machines, and Kawaloa was as far from that environment as she could possibly get. Late that month, Dad had an autograph session in Seattle. While he was there, I had lunch with my mother in the garden room of the Four Seasons Olympic Hotel. They conducted a fashion show as we ate, with models strolling between tables in expensive Paris gowns. Afterward, I drove Mom over to a jewelry store in an old building in downtown Seattle, where they would measure her wrist and remove gold links from her watch, since she had lost so much weight. The building didn't have an elevator, so I helped her up a long flight of stairs to the second floor. She was weak and frail, and had to rest on almost every step. My heart went out to her. I was confused and concerned by her physical downturn, because only a short while before she had been doing well with her exercise program, improving steadily. I hoped it was only a temporary setback, and that Hawaii would make her stronger. She seemed so much older than her 56 years. 2 days later, I drove Jan and the kids to Port Townsend, and we arrived at mid-morning. There were 5 deer in the yard. Dad came out to greet us in his customary fashion and gave us warm hugs. "Did you bring your manuscript?" he asked. I had completed Sudana Sudana only a couple of days before. Opening a back door of the car, I reached in and pulled a manuscript box off the ledge above the back seat. He took the story that I had sweated over these many months to the living room and set himself up on the couch. He seemed anxious to read it. Mom wanted to go over a number of business matters with me, and we went in her office. At her desk, I pulled up a chair to sit beside her. She gazed through a tall window that overlooked her garden and a little wooden bird feeder attached to a cedar tree. A brown and white wren was eating seeds, and she watched it for a moment. Her desk was more cluttered than usual, and she had a large green ledger book open on it, with a cross pencil lying on the exposed page. She was breathing hard, taking deep, erratic gulps of air, and I thought she was going to sneeze. Then I realized her breathing was labored from the exertion of walking into her office, only 30 feet from the kitchen. I wanted to help her, but I didn't know how. Touching her hand, I asked, "Mom, are you okay?" She smiled, looked at me, and said, "I'll be all right in just a moment." I saw pain in her dark blue eyes. To the left of her desk, on the side where I sat, stood a light teak filing cabinet with a miniature black-and-white Sony television on it. Above that, on the wall, a bookshelf held reference books, including a zip code directory, a Roget's thesaurus, and a big black hardcover volume, the new Cassell's German Dictionary. Between her desk and the doorway to the kitchen, a photocopy machine sat on a small oak library table that had belonged to her father, with manuscript pages stacked neatly beside the machine. A bulletin board by the doorway had little snips of paper and cartoons on it, including a number of cartoons Jan and I had sent. There were 2 large and significant items on the board. A smiling black-and-white photograph of Dad, much favored by my mother, in which he looked happy and regal in his full beard. And a complete list of the cast in the Dune movie, printed in large type. We talked about a number of accounting matters that she had been handling, and she showed me the incredible volume of bills she had to handle. Some of the entries in the ledger were in Dad's handwriting. I asked why she didn't hire an accountant or a bookkeeper to help her, not knowing at the time that Jan had asked her the same question during an earlier visit. "This is my work," she told me. "Frank has his work, and I have mine." I learned that foreign royalties went directly from foreign publishers to a bank in Zurich, Switzerland, with documentation then forwarded to Mom from the bank and from their literary agents. Mom made careful accounting entries for each deposit. They had a precious metals account in that bank as well, for gold and other metals in which they had invested. She said she had to be extremely careful not to release the account numbers to anyone, not even to their accountants, since anyone with those numbers could withdraw the funds. My mother took great pains to delete the account numbers from any document copies she distributed. She maintained 4 separate ledgers: Port Townsend, personal; Hanna, personal and construction; Herbert Limited Partnership, for domestic royalties and expenses; and Swiss, foreign royalties and investments. In addition, Dad kept separate check registers of his own, issuing drafts for everything imaginable. As part of her job with the partnership, for which she received a 6-figure income of her own, Mom re-entered every check that Dad had issued onto the main ledgers, lining out the entries in his personal registers as she did so. She needed to go to the bank that morning in downtown Port Townsend and asked if I would take her. So, without realizing what she was doing, her secret plan. I helped her to the car and drove her downtown. At Seattle First National Bank, she placed some Canadian gold coins in a safety deposit box and then introduced me to the bank employees she knew, including the vice president. We went into the office of an account executive, a middle-aged woman, and sat in front of her. Their mom described a number of accounting problems she had been experiencing. Mom left her business and personal bank records with the woman for help in figuring them out. I didn't realize until months later how these events fit neatly into a plan Beverly Herbert had in mind, one she never revealed to her husband, though I know now that he had guessed some of it. She had worked it out meticulously, and, unawares, I was part of it. Showing me the records in detail for the first time, introducing me to bank employees, it was all for transition. She wanted me to handle the financial affairs of my father if she didn't return from Hawaii. It was gray and drizzly as we drove back to the house, and Mom said, "I really hate this weather." Dad served lunch for all of us. It was a delicious chicken broth, thickened by pureed potatoes and pumpkin from their garden. No solids. He poured creme fraiche in the bottom of each soup bowl, sprinkled nutmeg on top of that, and poured the soup over it all. He made an entertaining production out of it and told us not to dump croutons in the soup. Instead, he had us place two of them in our bowls at a time, just enough for a spoonful to keep them crisp. I sat in the living room with Dad the rest of the afternoon while he read my novel. High on the gable wall beside us were the stained glass windows my father had designed, a rooster and a writer's quill, and through windows below I could see another writer's quill, this one a weather vane on top of the pool building. When he finished reading, he pronounced my story fit, but thought I might add more descriptive language in a couple of places. "You've come a long way," he told me. He said the novel had many marvelous passages and a good plot. I loved the way "marvelous" rolled across his tongue, as if you could taste the excellence of what the word was describing. That evening, all of us were standing in the living room looking out on the pond. We saw a small family of deer cut into the woods, one trailing after the other. The following Wednesday, October 5th, 1983, Dad drove Mom into Group Health Hospital in Redmond to run her through a battery of tests before they left for Hawaii. They hoped to leave by the 10th of the month. When I spoke with Dad at my house later that day, he said Mom had been afraid to see the doctor. Aside from increasing fatigue and shortness of breath, she had been experiencing backaches and was worried that her cancer had spread. Sometimes she awoke in the middle of the night and suffered silently, without disturbing him. She didn't want to make him tired, detracting from his ability to write. Dad found out about this and told her to wake him up at any time for a back rub. "What good am I if I can't do that?" he told her. So each night after that, he brought her warm milk in the middle of the night and massaged her back. "I tell her I love her when I do these things," he said, his voice full of emotion. "My hands tell her I love her too, as I massage her back." During Dad's stay with us, he ordered 4 live Maine lobsters from the Village Fish Market in New Canaan, Connecticut, sent by express and packed in seaweed and blue ice. Each lobster weighed at least 2.5 pounds, and they were sent directly from Connecticut to the Mirabeau restaurant in Seattle, where they would be prepared for a gala dinner the 4 of us were scheduled to have that evening. But after all the medical tests, Mom wasn't feeling well enough to join us. The doctor said she had been experiencing a problem with her potassium medication that had been making her ill, leading to the fatigue she had been feeling. It had to do with Slow-K, Dad said, a medicine to keep her potassium level up. So Dad, Jan, and I went to the restaurant. It wasn't the same without Mom, but we enjoyed my father's company nonetheless. With the lobster, we had a 1979 bottle of Pouligny Montrachet, Mom's favorite white wine. "And mine, too," Dad said. We discussed special effects in the Dune movie, which he said were impressive, particularly with respect to the weirding machine, the sandworms, the gilled fish creature Edric in a transparent tank, and the hunter-seeker units. While my father admired the special effects, he had a contractual reason for disputing the use of Edric in the Dune movie, as noted in Chapter 44. He said that he had been writing Dune 6 under the working title Hunters of Dune until Mom suggested the title he liked better, Chapter House Dune. Warner Brothers and Paul Newman were still after the film rights to Soulcatcher, and Dad was insisting upon doing the screenplay himself. He thought he might receive a six-figure fee for the task, in addition to funds from the sale of movie rights. "There are two juicy parts for Newman," he said, "the boy's father or the sheriff." In our usual wide-ranging conversation, we entered into the subject of pheromones, external hormones. Dad said people had them, and so did lower life forms, such as mosquitoes. He suspected that pheromones were responsible for mob hysteria and crowd activity in general, and for two women living together going on to the same menstrual cycle. He planned to investigate this. That week, I took my lunch to the hospital several times to be with my mother. On the way to her room on Friday, I saw Dad in a downstairs nurse's office and stopped to talk with him. He had his own test results in and didn't have an ulcer or the flu. No medical problems showed up in any of his tests. The doctors were correcting the problem with Mom's potassium medication, and she was feeling better. He said that no reason had been found for her backaches. In the hallway, he told me he was making arrangements for a special showing of Dune in Seattle, with the proceeds going to Group Health Cooperative, which he felt had been largely responsible for prolonging Beverly Herbert's life. It had been more than 9 years since she had been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. With the hospital's assistance, she had proved the statisticians wrong.
On Dad's birthday, Saturday, October 8th, he checked Mom out of the hospital and took her to her hairdresser in the Westin Hotel.
She looked trim and elegant when she and Dad stopped by the house for a short while. She said she was feeling better and smiled readily. They had hoped to leave for Hawaii by Monday, but that was delayed by my mother's bête noire, constant tests the doctors wanted to perform. She could hardly wait to return to Kawaloa. Saturday, the 15th of October, 1983, was the last time I ever saw my mother. I was 36 years old. It was a rainy day, around 60 degrees. I worked on Sudana Sudana in the afternoon, primarily moving key items forward in the story. We had dinner with Mom and Dad at Hugo's Rotisserie in the Hyatt Hotel near SeaTac Airport. Mom was in a wheelchair that squeaked because it had a bent wheel. As Dad pushed her through the long corridors of the hotel, from their room to the restaurant, I thought of the countless times I had been with them in similar places. For years, it had been an endless maze of hotel corridors, it seemed. We crossed the lobby, and I helped Dad carry Mom in her chair down a short flight of stairs, 3 steps. She wasn't very heavy. He pushed her to our table, a booth at the back of the restaurant, and she slid off the chair onto a seat. Mom didn't look well at all. She was tiny and terribly fragile, and I wondered why she had to be taken so far from modern hospitals and technology. Of course, she wasn't being taken, I realized. She was the prime mover in the drama and wanted to be at Kawaloa. Frank Herbert would do anything for her, in return for the love she had given him and for supporting the other love in his life, writing. Many women wouldn't have done the things for my father that she did. They would have told him to get a real job and support his family properly. Writing was, after all, a tremendous gamble. But she was a white witch, my father said. A good witch. Mom could predict events with frightening accuracy. In her heart, she had always known her husband would be successful one day. And now, as she prepared to leave for her beloved Kawaloa, she sensed her own future. She didn't eat a meal with us, had only a dish of vanilla ice cream. She was in obvious discomfort of some sort. I couldn't tell exactly what. Didn't feel I should ask. She was quiet, suffering inwardly. Still, she put on a gallant face and was intermittently cheerful. Mom was on my immediate left, and I placed my hand on hers. Her skin was cold and without fat, and I felt the bones and sinews of her hand. Such an inadequate covering for my mother, for this important person. I could only hope that she knew what was best for her, that her Kawaloa would regenerate her. She gripped my hand in hers, squeezed. We exchanged smiles, and I had to look away so that I wouldn't cry. Dad was telling a true story about a professor he knew at the University of Washington.
The professor pulled his car into a gas station that was within view of Western Washington State Hospital near Tacoma, a large institution for the mentally infirm.
His car needed water, but in error he grabbed an air hose and stuck it inside the radiator. The gas station attendant took one look at this and nodded toward the hospital. "Wait right here, sir," he said. "They'll be right over to help you." My father told other stories, one about a resident of the mental health facility in Napa, California. Something about wheel nuts and a tire being repaired. From my concern over my mother, I wasn't paying attention, and in a fog I heard the punchline, "I may be nuts, but I'm not stupid." I remembered other punchlines from other days, going back to when I was 6 years old at a tiny beach house we lived in near Tacoma, listening from the mezzanine while Dad told long, convoluted, shaggy dog stories. I was supposed to be in bed then, not eavesdropping. Now I was supposed to be listening, but wasn't. Kawalua became my mother's dream, her paradise on this planet. We all have dreams, but to some of us, they are only vague mental images or plans drawn on paper and never implemented. Some people only see the dreams of others and never realize their own. Beverly Ann Herbert obtained her dream house, and a magnificent palace it was, fit for any queen. She called it Kawalua, meaning a nice long time, but only spent a small portion of her life there. When she was away from her paradise, she longed to be back. She would be there the following day, where it was warm and comfortable. Kawalua beckoned, and I kissed her on her cheek for the last time. Chapter 36. There are flowers everywhere. On a Sunday in mid-October 1983, I was working on the final draft of Sudana Sudana. A phone call came in from my brother Bruce. He was in California, said he had seen Sydney's Comet in bookstores, that it was selling and being restocked. Other friends called to tell me the same thing. A few days later, on my mother's 57th birthday, I telephoned Hawaii to give her our love. She said she was tired, but better. "It's warm here," she said, "and there are flowers everywhere." They were planning to have dinner at home, and Dad was preparing a special low-salt recipe of oyster sauce beef for her, one of her favorite meals. In ensuing weeks, I spoke with my parents often, but made few journal entries. I needed a respite from the demands of the word-eating monster that sometimes threatened to consume me if I didn't feed it. And through the middle of November, I got my fill of writing anyway, finishing Sudana Sudana and mailing it to Clyde Taylor. I then set to work on a light project, a science fiction humor book in collaboration with an artist friend, Dick Swift. It wasn't easy working as an insurance agent and writing on the side, and I longed to write full-time. I understood now what my father must have been thinking during his own monumental struggle to make a living as a writer. There were many dimensions of him that I understood now only because I became, like him, a writer. "The best way to learn a thing is by doing it," he often said. And so it was, in learning about this enigmatic genius, Frank Herbert. The process of becoming a writer myself helped me to forgive him. In phone conversations across the Pacific, I usually spoke with Mom, for Dad was almost always working, trying to get out of a financial straitjacket. Mom carried a cordless telephone around with her, and usually sat with it in her favorite spot on a large gray sectional couch, where she could do her knitting and gaze out upon the sea. She didn't sound noticeably different to me, and never complained to me of discomfort. I was to learn later that Dad was dressing and bathing her, and that her condition had so deteriorated that she needed oxygen to sleep. I was to learn as well that Mom was being attended constantly by Dr. Howell, who lived a short distance down the road toward Cabo Gap. I wasn't told how bad it was getting. Or maybe there were things I should have heard, but didn't. I knew the swimming pool was under construction at Kawalua, for example, but I didn't fully understand the desperation my father felt to get it completed, so that Mom could resume the exercise program that had worked so well for her in the past. Work seemed to drag along on the pool, going at the special slow pace reserved for the tropics. The process took forever, he told me later. In every telephone conversation, I was told that Mom was doing better, that she was happy and warm. That November, they felt a strong earthquake at Kauloa, centered at Hilo on the Big Island of Hawaii. Dad said it lasted 45 seconds to a minute and felt like someone running across the deck. Months later, Dad told me he woke up once during the night and my mother was blue, a condition known as cyanosis from inadequately oxygenated blood. He noticed that the oxygen tube had fallen from her mouth, so with trembling hands he reconnected it, and her color returned. After that, he slept only lightly, listening for changes in her breathing pattern. He said he had been averaging just 3 hours of sleep a night. In the middle of December, we received a letter from my father. Dear Brian, Jan, and kids, this letter is being composed on the word processor that I am readying for Bev to use in writing all of our correspondence. It works much faster than ordinary typewriting and saves the letter on a disk that is much easier to store. One disk, 5.5 inches in diameter, can store hundreds of letters and find them when required, provided you label the disks correctly. As I write this letter, I can hear the workmen outside finishing the swimming pool. Bev really needs it desperately. Her muscle tone has gone down dangerously since our arrival, although she still is stronger than she was when we arrived. Dr. and Mrs. Howell were here for dinner last night and brought good news about Bev's latest blood test. She is managing to keep up her potassium level without taking the slow K that made her so ill just before we left Port Townsend. For Jen's information, the guest house is coming along rapidly as well. New apartment wing, attached to the main house by a covered walkway. The contractor put in the steel supports for the corner tables yesterday, and we decided to surface them with the same blue tile we are using in the bathrooms. We are overflowing with that tile because, on learning that they no longer are making it, we bought out the store's supply. We had visions of needed repairs sometime in the future, and no source for the tiles. We're really looking forward to Jan's visit, and only wish Brian would be with her. Too much activity around here to do much else except watch the work. I always say, I love work. I could watch it forever. Love, Frank. Chapter 37. The Race to Finish Kauloa. At this point in writing Dreamer of Dune, I found myself unable to continue. For many weeks, the manuscript languished, untouched, while I busied myself with other things, with make-work projects that were without substance. Ultimately, a great depression set in over me, for I was not writing, and beyond that, far beyond that, I was not telling the story that had burned in my heart for so long. One evening, I sat down at my computer to resume work on the book, but my fingers were numb on the keyboard, moving sluggishly, stumbling over keys and producing misspellings. My brain and fingers refused to cooperate in the telling of something so terrible. Fatigue overwhelmed me, and I wanted nothing more than to sit in the soft side chair by my desk and nap. It was the large orange Naugahyde chair that had been my mother's favorite, one she said leaped out and grabbed her as she tried to walk by it in a department store. Maybe tomorrow I would be able to proceed. But not this evening. Not now. I settled into the chair and fell asleep. Tomorrow arrived, and again I put the work aside. 3 more days passed, and eventually I looked through the old notes again. In December 1983, I set to work on an outline and some of the scenes for a new science fiction book that I hoped Dad and I might write together. A novelization that would include some of the America concepts we had been discussing. This was a book my mother very much wanted us to do, as she felt we might become like Irving Wallace and his son David Wallachinsky. But as I got into the outline, many of the America concepts didn't seem to fit. Instead, I envisioned a universe that was entirely dependent for its existence upon the imaginations of an alien race called Dreens. They lived on the planet Drenor and created entire worlds with the power of their imagination. Out of their imaginings, worlds came into existence. Earth was one of those worlds, and a situation would come to pass where the people of Earth would perceive a threat from aliens living on a distant planet, Drenor, and a military mission would be sent to destroy that far-off planet. Of course, Such an act could destroy Earth as well if all the Dreens were killed, since our planet only existed by virtue of the imaginations of these beings. But the military people on Earth would have no knowledge of such an impending catastrophe. The key character in our story would be a newspaper man, a young publisher who operated a paper owned by his business mogul father, a number cruncher who cared little about the newspaper industry and was more interested in his widespread, diversified enterprises, which were far more profitable than publishing. In many respects, our young protagonist would be modeled after William Randolph Hearst, who, like the character in our story, was left a newspaper by his wealthy father. The real-life newspaper owned by Hearst, the San Francisco Examiner, had been employer to both Frank Herbert and me in the 1960s, he as picture editor and me as a copy boy. And, of course, I had in recent years been intrigued with the life story of Hearst for the similarity he bore with my father when it came to ongoing construction projects. Dad liked the concept when I described it to him over the telephone. He liked my title, too. A Man of Two Worlds, a reference to the character becoming split in his obligations between the worlds of Draenor and Earth. Dad told me to go ahead and set the story up as much as I could. Shortly after Christmas 1983, Jan flew to the international airport at Honolulu on the island of Oahu. From there, she caught a Royal Hawaiian Air Service Cessna to the island of Maui. As she flew over the water, it was the most incredible aqua-blue color she had ever seen, breathtaking in its beauty and brilliance. The plane skirted Maui and headed for its eastern shore, where she beheld spectacular vistas of waterfalls, cliffs, and jungle. Tiny settlements and ranches were carved out of the jungle that ran up the slopes of the massive, inactive volcano Haleakala, the dominant topographical feature of the island. It had been a cold winter in Seattle, with rain and snow and temperatures dropping into the teens. But when Jan stepped out of the plane at the Hana Airport, it was 80 degrees with trade winds blowing gently. Darkness was just beginning to blanket the island. The airfield was a strip of pavement between the jungle and the sea. Dad greeted her at a little gate between the tarmac and a small terminal building and helped her load luggage and Christmas gifts into his white Chevrolet Blazer. Jan hadn't known about this vehicle, and when she commented on it, he said it was perfectly suited to their lifestyle in Hawaii. It was large, permitting them to fill it with groceries and other items during all-day shopping trips to the other side of the island. Necessary, because Hana had only two small general stores. The Blazer had four-wheel drive, enabling it to traverse rough roadways and off-road terrain. In the gathering dusk, Jan saw tropical beauty she had never imagined, with lush jungle vegetation and bright flowers pressing in all around the highway, threatening to overwhelm civilization. Dad drove as if he didn't own the vehicle, too rapidly and with little respect for rough spots in the road. The Blazer wasn't that old, but already the shock absorbers were shot and it rocked crazily on every bump. He spoke of construction work at the house and said, with great concern, if we could only get the pool done. Bev could do her strokes. She'd be stronger then. Her heart would get better. Jan knew the unspoken, that he meant improvement of her whole cardiovascular system, including her lungs. They passed the luxurious Hotel Hana Maui and the quaint, busy Hasegawa's General Store, about which a popular Hawaiian song had been recorded. Outside town were large green pastures, most of them the property of the Hana Ranch, owners of the hotel, with black lava rock, tumble-down fences, and cattle grazing. There were outstanding vistas of the sea. The road became worse on this side of town and seemed to have been paved in a prior century, so filled with potholes and washboards was it. The natives liked it that way, Dad said with a chuckle as they went over the eyeball-rattling, bumpy stretch known as the Molokai Washboard. It kept visitors to a minimum. I'm one of the natives now, he said proudly. A kama'aina. We've been very well accepted by the community. 5 miles down a road that seemed like much farther, by the second fruit stand out of town, Dad slowed and wheeled sharply left, rolling over a metal cattle guard that kept hoofed intruders off his property. The cattle guard, which rattled when they crossed it, had been installed after a Hana Ranch bull chased my mother around the yard. From the parking area, as Jan got out of the car, she saw the hip roof of the main house just downhill and palm trees along the shoreline, swaying gently in trade winds. The sea, a darker shade of blue in receding daylight, stretched far into the distance. On the far right, she could barely make out the outline of the island of Hawaii and its nearest volcano, Mauna Kea. A flower-lined walkway curved downhill to the entrance of the main house. When Jan walked in the door, with Dad just ahead of her toting luggage, he called out, "Bev, I brought your sunshine." Mom rose from the gray sectional couch in the living room and walked slowly toward her eagerly awaited visitor, smiling broadly. My mother was thin, only 110 pounds on a 5'7" frame, and her skin was ivory, in striking contrast with her dark brown hair. A delicate whisper of a woman, she wore an exquisite red Polynesian muumuu, red with pink and white flowers. "Oh, finally," she exclaimed, "our breath of fresh air. Frank, everything will be all right now. Jan's here." To one of my parents, Jan was sunshine, and to the other, fresh air. Mom took Jan outside, and on the hill facing the kitchen showed her where she had planted poinsettias. "I planted them for you," she said, and she expressed worry that the caretakers might not water them enough. Jan didn't ask about this, but wondered why anything in Hawaii needed extra watering. Maybe it had to do with how young the plants were, she thought, or the time of year. An apartment wing had been completed on the other side of the pool that was still under construction. But the apartments, two of them, were a good distance from the main house and only reachable by going outside and traversing a long covered walkway. My mother thought Jan might be lonely out there, so they set her up on a Japanese futon folding mattress on the mezzanine of the main house. "You'll be cozier here," Mom said. Her voice was weak, filled with sickness. The following morning, Jan saw beauty she had never imagined possible. Kawaloa, a 5-acre piece of paradise brimmed with flowers, breadfruit trees, palms, papaya trees, and banana fronds, at the edge of an aquamarine sea with dancing whitecaps. A few days later, the poinsettias were not doing well, and my mother became displeased with the caretakers, Bart and Sheila Rast, saying they weren't watering the plants enough. Mom's displeasure reached the ears of her enforcer, my father, and he became very angry. He wanted everything to be perfect for her, didn't want her upset in the least because of her precarious medical condition. Dad got on the phone to the caretakers, who were in a separate house on the upper level of the property, by the Hana Road, and said, "Get down here and water the poinsettias. We don't want them to die." Jan and Sheila became friends, and Jan learned that Sheila loved my mother dearly and tried to do everything she could to please her. The poinsettias had been watered, she insisted. They just weren't adapting well. She showed Jan around the land, which was nearly 5 acres, with 330 feet of ocean front. The grounds were exquisitely kept. After visiting Sheila one day, Jan returned by herself to the main house, where Mom made a surprising remark. "Don't ever get too close to the help," she said. "It's best to keep your distance." Jan found this pretentious, but didn't argue. It was one of my mother's few flaws that she had a tendency towards snobbishness, even when we had been poor. Subsequently, Jan was more discreet when she visited Sheila, waiting until Mom was taking a nap. My wife spent 2 weeks there, and in that time noticed that Dad hardly ever went anywhere, so worried was he about my mother. Any time he went to town without her, he couldn't stand to be away, and drove even faster than usual. The locals were learning to watch out for him on the road. On one occasion, he became impatient trying to get around another car and went up a shortcut by the Pu'uiki Cliff, blew a stop sign, and roared back onto the Hana Road just ahead of the other vehicle. Each day, Dad spent time in his study, but when Jan passed his open door and looked inside, she could see he wasn't writing much. He would sit at his computer and stare at it, or move his fingers listlessly over the keyboard, where once they had danced across the keys with furious energy. Dad was forever listening for Mom to be sure she was all right. If she so much as whimpered his name, he bolted out of the study to help her. He was overly attentive at times, to the point where Mom grew irritated with him and would say, "Jan's here. You can go back to work." Because of the heat in his upper-level study, a tropics-related design problem he hadn't contemplated, he regularly wrote with his shirt off. He looked so sad to Jan, rarely smiling or breaking into laughter, making her suspect he cried in private, and that he was pretending to write or trying to write through tears. Whenever he came downstairs, he invariably looked sweaty and upset. My mother tried not to disturb him, except when she had to. She liked him upstairs working. She wanted everything to be normal, the way it used to be. But she must have sensed that he was not writing wholeheartedly, and that he was way behind schedule on Chapter House Dune. With all the diuretics she had to take and her lack of energy, little accidents were inevitable and embarrassing for Mom. She would try to make it to the bathroom, but after only 4 steps would be out of breath, leaning on the wall. One day Dad was away briefly, and Jan tried to help her, but she wouldn't allow it, saying she only allowed Frank to help her. My mother could be stubbornly independent. But Jan said to her, "After all the years you've helped me, won't you let me do this for you?" The woman she knew as Bev, the woman who would become a mother to her, smiled gently at this and said, "All right." Mom relied on her more after that. At bedtime, Dad normally came down from his study to help her. But this evening, while Dad worked in his study, Mom allowed Jan to assist her to bed and told her how the oxygen was to be hooked up. This was a shock. Jan had seen 2 tanks in the bedroom, but hadn't known they were in constant use, thinking they were only there just in case. Jan eased her into bed and connected the oxygen. Just before shutting out the light, Jan kissed her on the cheek, as I had done so many times. Her face felt cold. On her nightstand, my mother kept a Catholic rosary, given to her by the nuns from Tacoma when she had been close to death almost a decade before. Simple black beads and a brass cross bearing Jesus. She also had a scapular, 2 tiny pieces of rectangular woolen cloth connected by a string. The scapular bore pictures of Catholic saints, with the words, "Have pity on us, and be our aid." Each night before she went to sleep, she held the religious artifacts and prayed. My mother attributed her extra years of life in large part to a newfound faith in God. Not particularly in the Catholic version of God, or in anyone else's version of a deity. Instead, Beverly Herbert was a free thinker who did not easily accept the constructs of others. Each morning, Jan prepared breakfast, usually serving Mom in bed on a tray according to strict dietary requirements. A bowl of cream of wheat and banana slices, with fresh guava or papaya juice. Alongside, Jan placed a fresh hibiscus flower in a little crystal vase, a vase I had given my mother some years before. During the day, Mom liked to sit in the V of the sectional couch, which gave her commanding views of the home's interior and the ocean. Jan helped set her up each day, providing pillows, bringing books and knitting materials, and placing the cordless telephone nearby. Jan prepared all the meals and performed other tasks my father normally did, making her realize the full extent of the time-consuming chores he performed out of love. Prior to Jan's visit, Mom hadn't allowed anyone but him to help her, so he was her medical attendant, masseur, and personal chef. He cleaned the house, did her laundry, made and changed her bed, performed her bookkeeping chores, wrote letters for her, and bathed her. In caring for a person this ill, he was forced to reach deep for the strength he needed. The fatigue showed on his drawn face, with dark circles under his eyes. He had gained a lot of weight, more than 50 pounds at one point from nervous eating, from the stresses of building the house at Kawaloa and not knowing from day to day if the woman he was building it for would survive to see it completed. He had more wrinkles, more gray hairs. His beard and hair, usually neatly trimmed, were long and unkempt. In recent weeks, he had begun losing weight, having lost his appetite and enthusiasm for food. 10 of the 50 pounds had fallen off. Jan tried to make certain he ate a balanced diet each day, but often he wouldn't finish what she put in front of him, and she would have to remove it. At times, he seemed listless. Each morning, Mom had to take her medicine. But once, while Jan was there, she resisted, saying it didn't taste good. She was seated in her usual place on the couch, with the medicine on the black slate table in front of her. Dad came up behind Mom and started rubbing her neck and shoulders. He pushed his hand inside the back of her sweater to massage her upper back, and as he did so, said, "I'm not getting fresh." "I wish you were," she said, with with a winsome smile. Jan wanted to paint the glorious Hawaiian countryside around her, one very special afternoon, with warm, gentle trade winds blowing in from the sea. Mom followed Jan out on the deck. Barely able to walk, Mom went 6 feet, held on to something, and then struggled another 6 feet. They sat by the pool, where Jan sketched and painted. Adding to what she had taught Jan before, Mom described more of the techniques her mother had used, this time in the mixing and matching of watercolors and in brushstrokes. And while she did not have the energy to paint, she enjoyed watching Jan spread colors and shapes on paper. "Yes, that's it," Mom would say. "You're very talented." Inside the house, my mother showed Jan a number of sketches and paintings she had done when they first moved to Kawaloa, when all the excitement of the tropical scenery was new and fresh in her mind. One painting was of the house and garden, a happy production full of bright flowers. Another was a potted flower drawn in black ink. Mom gave Jan a set of Japanese watercolor paints with colors in little porcelain dishes. While Mom was napping one day, Jan went out on the deck by the stairway that led up to the caretaker's house and painted a picture of a lacy coral hibiscus and a bright red ostrich plume ginger. Looking around the side of the main house, she had a glimpse of the water, but most of that view was blocked by the house. Mom awoke and saw her out there. Slowly, painstakingly, she worked her way outside and came up behind Jan to admire her work. Jan set up a chair for her and ran back inside to get my mother's favorite wool shawl for her shoulders. In one of their conversations, Mom told Jan she was sorry she hadn't spent more time with her grandchildren, but that if she kept her distance, it wouldn't hurt them so deeply when she passed away. Jan had suspected as much. Sadly, she thought of how much Kim resembled her grandmother as a teenager, with baby fat that would soon melt away, revealing hidden beauty. They shared an interest in astrology, in sewing and knitting, and had many other similarities of personality, especially in the subtle ways of obtaining what they wanted. Still, Jan held out hope for future closeness between Bev and the girls, and found it hard to accept that my mother was dying. Dad also spent time with Jan. He alternated between depression and optimism, refusing to believe his wife of nearly 4 decades might not be able to continue. Proudly, he showed Jan his computer system. From his non-stop nursing duties and trying to meet a writing deadline, he had let his personal appearance slip. So he asked Jan to neaten him up with a haircut and beard trim. While cutting his hair, Jan noticed a large mole on his back and said, "Frank, this looks like it needs taken care of." "I'll have it looked at," he assured her, "when I get back to the mainland." During Jan's visit, the swimming pool was finally completed and filled with water. The solar heating unit was not functioning yet, so the water was too cold for Mom. Dad and Jan swam, however. The pool was large and beautiful, just off the master bedroom. Partially completed redwood decks surrounded it. And on one section, in a chair beneath the shade of an Italian umbrella, Jan often gazed out over the magical, shimmering sea. To pay for the remaining construction he wanted for Mom, Dad took out a large bank loan. "I'm expecting movie money soon," he told Jan. He then sought interior design advice from her as to how they might decorate the main house and the apartment wing. At 3:30 one morning, Jan awoke to noises. From her futon bed on the mezzanine floor, she heard someone walking around and a sliding door opening and closing. She went in Dad's study, and through an open skylight heard a splash and someone swimming in the pool. It was my father, taking a wake-up dip before going to work in his study. This was his daily routine, rising earlier than ever so that he could have precious writing time alone while Mom slept. After swimming his lengths, he squeezed fresh orange juice and prepared a light breakfast for himself. Jan discovered that Dad was taking no-dose tablets to stay awake, to work through intense fatigue as he sought to keep the writing deadlines that were so important to him. At times, Jan needed to get away alone. Sensing this, Mom told her to take the Blazer and drive to nearby Hamoa Beach, owned by the Hotel Hana Maui. From dues they paid, my parents had the right to use the recreational area, described by Dad as the most beautiful stretch of white sand beach he had ever seen. Jan sat on one of the lounge chairs provided by the hotel and cried for Bev, hardly noticing a famous actress who was seated nearby, Julie Newmar. A man in his 40s approached Jan and introduced himself as Smitty. Friendly and compassionate, he said he was a preacher and that he lived in a cave nearby. He wore boxer shorts and a faded Hawaiian shirt. Jan told him about my mother. "Let's say a prayer for her," Smitty suggested. And for long minutes, they prayed together, silently. Later, Jan learned he was quite a well-known personality in those parts, known as Born Again Smitty, a man who had saved many swimmers from the dangerous surf and undertow just offshore. Tragically, Smitty died a short while later when the cave in which he lived collapsed on him. He was one of many people living off the land around there, in shacks or caves, fishing and picking fruit from the jungle. No one starved, not even people who didn't fish, because of the abundance of bananas, papaya, guava, breadfruit, and other fruit that grew readily in that climate. When Jan arrived home from Hamoa Beach, she came in late, having lost track of time. "Where the hell were you?" Dad demanded. "I was just about to call the police. I had people driving around looking for you." She apologized for causing concern and hurried in to prepare dinner. Later, during one of her visits to Hamoa Beach, Jan made these notes. "When I think of Bev and how she must feel inside, I hurt for her. She has always been so strong. But now I think she would welcome death from all the hurt and sorrow she has suffered. I will miss her so very much that I hope she will hold on for us all. Today I feel so sad inside for all of us who love her. I wish to leave this beautiful place only because I cannot watch her hurt. And I miss my babies and Brian." A short while afterward, Jan asked my father if she could leave a few days earlier than expected, so that she could get back to Margot, who was only 2, and take care of other obligations. She said nothing about her real reason. If my father sensed anything else, he didn't comment, though his eyes were filled with pain. Jan knew as well that my sister Penny would arrive soon to help out. Bruce had wanted to come afterward, but Dad was delaying in giving him a time that would be convenient. My brother wondered, but did not say so to Dad, if this had anything to do with his homosexuality, which our father had never accepted. A couple of days later, when it was time to leave, Jan said goodbye to Mom, who was too weak and fatigued to rise from the gray sectional couch. Mom wore her colorful Mizzoni shawl and her favorite red cotton muumuu with pink and white flowers. Jan had ironed the dress for her that morning. "Thank you, dear." Beverly's face was a mask of sadness and pain. "You've been a big help." Jan leaned over, kissed the frail woman on her cheek, and hugged her. Then she turned quickly to leave, because she didn't want my mother to see her crying. From the front entry, she looked back at the woman who had become a mother figure to her. A mounting fear filled Jan, a terror that it was the last time she would ever see her. And she saw in Mom's face that she sensed this as well. The leaving process was like slow motion to Jan, a terrible pulling and wrenching. She didn't want to go, wanted to look upon Bev just a little longer, wanted to be with her for just a few moments more. On the way to the Hana airport, Dad said, "You know she's dying." Jan couldn't respond. It was why she needed to leave. She didn't feel she had the strength my mother saw in her, and was torn between wanting to help and fearing the imminence of death. My father was torn as well, in different ways. One moment he believed Mom might die, and the next moment he didn't believe it. Whenever the terrible reality of her fragility hit him, he tried to overcome it with his powerful sense of optimism, his knowledge of what the human spirit, particularly my mother's, could accomplish. She had survived so many close calls that it seemed to many of us that she would continue to beat the dread disease that afflicted her body. Like my father, we always held out hope. His optimism was contagious, and I hung on the slender thread of hope that he spun, without realizing how tenuous it was, or how fragile he was himself. Of course, I was spinning my own threads as well, my own illusions. shortly after Jan left. He wrote to me on Kawaloa stationery. Dear Brian, here are the two insurance checks we discussed on the phone. Let me know if I committed a goof. Bev always took care of these things for us, and I'm sometimes not as careful with them as I should be. Mind off somewhere in current book. She's very slightly improved today, but as the doctor says, she is walking a very fine line with her medication. We keep our spirits up, though, and Hannah is good for both of us. Bill Dana said the other day that this is a very spiritual place. I think maybe he's right. The saws are buzzing outside as they complete the deck around the pool, looking beautiful, and Bev is showing signs of impatience to get into warm water. Soon. We enjoyed Jan's visit, and she was a great help to us both. By the way, tell her we received a letter from Kim to her and sent it back, returned to sender. It should arrive in a day or so. Love from your papa. Frank. Mom had my father's fighting abilities and his sense of determination, and he had hers. They were, as each of them often said, one. Different parts of the same organism. At times, Dad tried to intellectualize her condition, and these were the worst times for him, when he had to face stark, cold medical facts. He was the most optimistic when he permitted his heart full rein, when he believed she would pull through and convinced himself she would. He convinced her of this, I am sure. Curiously, though he, like my mother, never accepted any formal religion, he was basically a man of faith, and this made him good and true and strong. It made him capable of writing books that inspired millions of readers. It enabled him to become, at long last, a father to me. Over the decade that the precious human cargo known as Beverly Herbert had been fighting for her life, first against cancer and then against heart disease brought on by radiation treatment, all of us grieved for her. We expected the worst at any moment, but hoped for the best. When Jan arrived home from Kawaloa, she couldn't talk about all of the sadness. She didn't show me what she had written at the beach or fill me in on all the details, such as the oxygen my mother had to take to get through each night. Jan looked numb, lower than I had ever seen her, and just said, "Your mother is dying." I couldn't believe it. Didn't want to believe it. Didn't want to talk about it. I didn't ask probing questions, things hindsight tells me I should have asked. But I had a terrible, ominous feeling. For weeks, I had been battling a bad case of the flu. I was tired and really depressed. For the first time in my life, I called the airport and made a reservation for a flight on an airliner to Hawaii. Then I reread Dad's recent letter, in which he said Mom was slightly improved. And I deluded myself. The swimming pool was almost ready, and soon she would be in the water, resuming the exercise program that had worked so well for her in the past. My terrible fear of flying returned and overwhelmed me. I couldn't go through with the flight after all, and canceled it, without ever having told my parents I'd made it. The poinsettias my mother planted on the hillside did not survive. Chapter 38. A Woman of Grace. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 7 through 8. Resuming her interior design classes early in 1984, Jan was given an opportunity to study at an extension class that summer at the University of Paris at the Sorbonne. We discussed it, but were wavering because of the high cost of the trip, including lodging at a pension, boarding house in Paris, near Luxembourg Palace. We had the problem of childcare, too. Julie was going through a rebellious stage at 15, and was quite a handful. Margot was quite young, only a toddler. So Jan telephoned my mother and told her about the situation, expressing concern about leaving little Margot and her sisters in my care for an entire summer. My God, Jan, Mom exclaimed. An opportunity like that doesn't come along every day. And making a reference to Jan's ancestry, she said, You're French, aren't you? You have to go. Jan had a feeling she would disappoint my mother if she didn't go, and beyond that, Mom was right. Opportunities like that weren't likely to come along again soon. We talked about it more, decided in favor of it, and made the reservations. She would leave in late May. On January 25th, 1984, I wrote to Mom, enclosing my usual light fare, and among other things, said to her, I'm working hard on an outline of a science fiction story to present to Dad for possible collaboration. Working title, A Man of Two Worlds. I spoke with her a couple of days later, and she said Dad had given her the sweetest, most intriguing note. It said, There is no real or unreal, only what we create together. I found a similar entry in Chapter House Dune, just one of many passages indicating he was thinking of her when he wrote the book. I stand in the sacred human presence, as I do now, so should you stand someday. I pray to your presence that this be so. Let the future remain uncertain, for that is the canvas to receive our desires. Thus the human condition faces its perpetual tabula rasa. We possess no more than this moment where we dedicate ourselves to the sacred presence we share and create. In Frank Herbert, William Tupont said that many strong independent women's voices could be heard in Chapter House Dune. This is an indication not only of my father's grief concerning my mother, who died during the writing of the book, but of his recognition of the contribution she made to the Dune series and to his other writings. One morning my mother awoke earlier than usual and sat up in bed. The long vertical blinds over the windows were open, and she gazed through them at a golden sunrise. The sun was rising on another perfect day in paradise, but she felt her life setting. She heard my father pass her door and called out to him. "Good morning, darling," he said in response, then nuzzled his bearded face against her cheek and kissed her. "Would you like breakfast now?" "Maybe later. I just want to sit here for a while. Look at that glorious sunrise." Dad felt a surge of hope, because she was smiling and her voice sounded strong. Beverly Herbert gazed out on the water as if hypnotized by it. "Call if you need me," he said, and he went back to his book, the one she had named, Chapter House Dune. On January 30th, Dad called and spoke with Jan while I was out. He was in tears, said Mom refused to eat. "She wants to die," he said. "She's slipping away." Penny was there with him, helping. He was having a cardiac specialist fly in from Honolulu. I wasn't home when he called because I had lost my wallet, something I never did, and I was searching for it in the woods where I had been gathering kindling. I didn't find it, and when I returned, Jan told me of the call. Somehow I seemed to be feeling my mother's anguish, as before, from far across the ocean. It was sending scattered signals through my brain, leaving me in dazed confusion. I reached Dad by telephone, and he sounded dismal. He said Mom refused to go to a hospital, where they could hook her to life support equipment. "She doesn't want to die in a hospital," he said. There were long periods of silence and broken sentences when he couldn't talk. I told him I loved him. He canceled the scheduled book tour. The following day, I called him again. He said the specialist had given Mom medicine that was working well, and that she was starting to eat once more. Dad was planning to hire a private jet with medical equipment to bring her back to Seattle in March or April. That was 2 or 3 months off, so I thought the emergency had passed. He said things were better, under control. That evening, I wrote a letter to my parents. "Dear Mom and Dad, I know these have been hard times for both of you. Each of you have always drawn strength from the other over the years, and now we worry about both of you. Dad, I know you're tired, and I know Mom is too, so it may be hard for each of you to give and take the strength that is needed to go on. I wanted you to know that we are here to draw upon for whatever extra measure of support you need. In the past years, we've enjoyed many fine dinners and good conversations together. During the last 5 or 6 years in particular, I think, Jan and I began to think of both of you as friends as well as parents. There is a bond there which goes beyond love, I suppose, if that's possible. Maybe it's a special kind of love, or a special kind of friendship. Somehow, Mom, you have to reach for that intangible extra. You were a strong person, and I hope you know the depth of what we feel for you. Margot is showing some of the Herbert artistic talent. She loves to dance, and last night was spinning to the music to the point of dizziness. She just kept going around in circles, getting giddy as she did so. She also likes to rub Daddy's shoulders to relax the tight muscles after a hard day at the office. She's smart, having seen Jan do that for me only once. Margot is trying to be good, too. If she spills something, she often tries to clean it up. And she's carrying a lot of stuff around with her all the time. Her new Christmas doll, a blanket, a bottle, and a little pillow. It makes me think of Linus in the Peanuts cartoons. Her vocabulary is increasing by leaps and bounds, but she has trouble with the L sound. Pillow, for example, comes out pitto. I am enclosing cards that Kim and Julie made up for you. They miss both of you, as we all do. Love, Brian. On February 3rd, I spoke with Dad, and he said Mom was doing a little better. We discussed A Man of Two Worlds, and it looked like we would definitely write the book together. He suggested the title Man of Two Worlds instead, which he thought would be stronger, and I agreed. The newspaper element in the story would concern a high-technology communications empire with a strong lead character. Dad had spoken with his literary agent about it, who felt we might obtain a large advance for the book. We spoke of sending him a short outline of our proposed plot, perhaps 2 pages. When Mom woke up the next morning, she said to Dad in a faraway voice, "You will fall in love with a younger woman." "Oh, no," he insisted, "that would never happen. And besides," he told her, "he didn't want her talking that way, as if she weren't going to be around." On February 5th, Dad called and said Mom had taken a sudden turn for the worse. The doctor only gave her 3 days to live. There was nothing to be done for her now, he said. His voice wavered, and he couldn't talk for several moments. "I'm sorry for breaking down," he said finally. I felt numb. "You don't need to apologize, Dad. I love you. Tell Mom I love her." He mentioned an unusual incident that occurred several days before, when Mom sat up suddenly in bed and said, "I just saw Federico De Laurentiis, son of the Dune movie producer. He was talking to me." She had been especially fond of young Federico, who had died some years earlier in an Alaskan plane crash. "This was a common experience," my father told me, "in which dying people had visions of those already gone." I also spoke with Penny, who was still with him. She was in tears. For several hours,